I'd become interested in radio in high school. There were a bunch of us that used to build little one valve sets and crystal sets and stuff like that. And I saw that there was a job going in the Queensland Police Force as a cadet with the radio section. They used to call it the wireless section in those days. I went for the interview and I got offered a cadetship with them. The cadetship involved technical training, administrative stuff. Essentially, you could look forward to being a technician first in the Queensland Police Force, but you would eventually be required to do police probationary exams and become a policeman. But you were always seen as being a technical type. We cadets had workshop training. We were enrolled as radio apprentices in the technical college, and we also, on our own behalf, there was another chap and I who started at the same time, we took correspondence course with what was then called the Marconi School of Wireless. The technical qualifications the highest technical qualifications that were required were essentially maritime or radio broadcast technicians. The maritime qualifications included subjects that permitted you to become a ship's officer, radio officer, and the reason for that, why that was promoted more than the broadcast side of it, was that in those days, the police services around the states communicated for urgent traffic between themselves with their own transmitters and receivers, but the method of communication was Morse code. Why the emphasis was on the maritime qualifications, because there was a Morse code test. The whole tests were administered by the Postmaster General's Department, and so we studied to get the first-class commercial ticket, as it was called, as the highest technical qualification. Now, apart from that, we did time in the little store that we had, and, you know, just admin stuff to learn the broad scope of what was involved with the police radio setup. And in those days, the police had two-way communication with their cars. They were using FM mobile communication systems manufactured by AWA. But as far as the interstate Morse-type traffic, that was using old ex-military transmitters, but specially designed by receivers designed by Tom and Smith or AWA. Now, interstate communication was also the same mechanism was used within Queensland to get urgent messages to two other northern cities, Rockhampton and Townsville. They had a staff of technicians and operators who could operate the telegraphic traffic 24 hours a day. So that was what we could look forward to as young cadets, and we were trained both in theory and practice, both on the job and at the tech. The Marconi School of Wireless was in addition, it was additional theory, which we did in our own time. And we used to write away letters every week with the answers to all these questions. You then had to become a policeman, and you became a probationary constable, and you did the 3 months, I think it was in those days, full-time training. And then when you passed the exams, you were assigned, and we, because of our cadetship, we were assigned straight back to the wireless section, which then gave the officer in charge, who in those days was a guy who'd started it all off. He was a sergeant at that point, Herb Springer, very active ham radio guy. He then had the pleasure of having a couple more staff that he could put on shift and take some of the more senior guys off and put them on full-time maintenance work. I was a shift operator with the Queensland Police radio, and I used to send Morse traffic to all states and to Townsville and Rockhampton as required. You didn't solely work as an operator. You were multitasking. You could leave some of the, if you're on day shift, you could leave one or two of the cadets who were learning all the process to keep an ear out for you and even take some traffic for you. And you could work in the workshop repairing generally the car radios, which were pretty, they were not as robust as modern stuff is.
All valve setups, I guess, were they?
Yeah, they were all valves. And it was interesting when we talk about the old components. AWA made some special sized two-way FM units for motorbike use, and we mounted these on several motorbikes. They didn't last more than one or two days before the little dish ceramic capacitors that we used all fell off with the vibrations. So that was back to the drawing board for AWA. But so we used as reasonably modern equipment as could be expected in the workshop, oscilloscopes and sweep generators and this sort of stuff to set up the equipment. So I got a first-class commercial certificate because in the process of doing that, you would get what was called a second class, which was a little bit less technical, theoretical knowledge required, a little bit less speed on the Morse sending and receiving. But in 1959, September 59, I got my first class ticket, which then permitted me, if I wanted to go to sea as a radio officer. I didn't really know where I was going, but I started university a couple of years later after doing evening classes to get my senior certificate. And when I wanted to go to uni, the Queensland Police weren't very flexible in allowing me to go there. They just said, "What do you want that for?" They wouldn't change my shifts, and in the end, two things happened. One, I saw an advert for a job in Woomera with the Weapons Research Establishment as a technician. The other thing was my mate Bill Miller, who I'd known and who I'd relieved up in Cairns, where they've had built a radio station in between time. He had got a job in Woomera, out on the range, working under Tom Reed. So Bill said, "Oh, well, you know, come down, and it's all great down here." So I did apply for a job, and it actually took Weapons Research 9 months to finally, between interview and offering of the job, they were, you know, they were very slow. So in the middle of 1962, with them not giving me much flexibility at going to uni, and having an offer of a job in Woomera, I left the Queensland Police. That was in 20th of May 1962. And I think I had a week or so at home, and then I had a week, not really a week, 5 days driving down to Woomera, having a holiday in between times, towing my worldly belongings and a little trailer behind my Volkswagen. So I started down there in the beginning of June 1962. Now, I called into this friend of mine who was living down there. He was married at that time. And I said, you know where I'm working? Yeah, yeah, you're working out at the Dish. Right, right. And I said, oh, that sounds terrific. What does that mean? He says, oh, that's out with NASA, out at Isle Lagoon. Oh, great. So anyway, I went to my organised accommodation, which was the staff mess, as it was called. Woomera was a secure village of 5,000 people. It was security was fairly tight. It was the Cold War era, and to get in there you had to have ASIO clearance and whatever, and that's probably what took a lot of the time to get applicants processed. But anyway, I can't be sure of that. But anyway, I went to the staff mess. They assigned me a single man's room, which was a little wooden, well, you'd call it a room in a long, typical military type of hut. There would have been 15 or so of these rooms in one long building. You just walk straight out of your room onto a veranda, and that ran the whole length of the building, and that was it.
Fairly Spartan then.
Yeah, very Spartan indeed. So I then had to go through the formalities of whatever you had to do. I can't remember, but there would have been formalities. And I was then driven out to Island Lagoon, where I was interviewed by the director of the site, who was Dr. Norm Gerard. Mm-hmm. He was in charge of both the Dish and the Minitrack tracking systems.
Was he the station director, or was he...
He was the complex director. I don't know his official title anymore, but Norm Gerard was over the top of Bill Metier, who was in charge of the Dish, and Jake Kerr, who was the senior technical officer in charge of Minitrack. After talking with Norm Gerard, he rang up, and Jake Kerr from Minitrack came down and said, well, you're with us. Well, that's great. So I went over to Minitrack, and I was introduced to the staff there. And I was, at that point, a technician with the Weapons Research Establishment, Commonwealth employee on the low end of the rungs. But, my assignment, if you like, was to the actual Minitrack system itself. Minitrack was the first land-based tracking system that was devised for Earth-orbiting satellites of the American space program. And I think you and I, Cole, have talked about this before.
The Minitrack was a system for determining the orbits of Earth-orbit satellites. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. But allied with the tracking system was a receive and command system for the later generation spacecraft after the Explorer 1, which had telemetry systems more complex than the early satellites. So there was a telemetry section and a tracking section, if you like, in this Minitrack building. But as shifts went along everybody became multi-skilled, and while we may have had more responsibility at one end of the room than the other, we worked pretty much as a team. But, you know, if you were the mini-track specialist, you made sure that the passes that you've been scheduled to cover were covered. You might have let somebody else have a go just to broaden their training and skills. But so I started off under the tutelage of a guy, an ex-Navy guy called, I think it was Edwin Kelly, but he was colloquially called Ned Kelly. How could you miss?
Yes.
he was a technical officer who did work shifts with me in tow until I was skilled enough to be able to take on whatever was required, and that sort of took about 6 to 9 months, I suppose, to learn enough about the system to be left there on my own as part of a shift. Now, the shift was probably only, in the mini-track side of things, was probably only 4 people. There would have been two mini-track operators at the most and 2 telemetry command, because there were quite a few spacecraft up by that time, Earth-orbiting spacecraft, that is, and that was the thing of the mini-track system. It was designed to track and give orbit information initially of Earth-orbiting satellites. The telemetry and command stuff came along a year or two later after it was initiated. So that's the sort of introduction that I had to the NASA situation.
How many satellites would you have been tracking, roughly? Any guess?
In the first instance, when I was there, there weren't a lot. You would do 4 or 5 passes a day, a shift, and there may have been 2 passes of the one satellite. The satellites were, as far as we were concerned, given some sort of launch number. It was 1962 Zeta or something like that. They all had Greek suffixes.
Okay.
From their launch date. There would have been 61 Omicron. Later on there was 63 Beta Gamma and so on. That's the way we knew the spacecraft.
Okay, so you didn't use the popular names?
No. And when you were annotating a mag tape for the telemetry side of stuff, that's what you did. You said it's past so-and-so of 1962 Omicron.
Your network connection would have been to Goddard, was it?
Yeah, it was Goddard. I've got to distinguish all the time between the tracking side of it, the mini-track, and the telemetry side of it, because I start to merge those things because, you know, I just talk about mini-track and it was the 2 functions. The tracking side of it was concerned with the spacecraft's radio signal crossing the lines of latitude and longitude that the antenna field defined.
Mm-hmm.
The mini-track antenna was a passive antenna, and it was able to determine the spacecraft passing through the lines of longitude and latitude, and the phase meters used to punch out the phase angles in what was called a medium channel, a coarse channel, and a fine channel on both latitude and longitude. Now, they would be output on a Sanborn 8-channel recorder, one mm-hmm. channel for each type of data, and I can't remember what the other couple of spare channels were, maybe just in case one channel blew up, mm-hmm. which wasn't uncommon. As well as the Sanborn record, you also punched out a digital paper tape, which was essentially teletype format, bow dot paper tape. Now, to know when you were approaching the what was called the Meridian Crossing, we had done previous calibrations of the antenna field with the RAAF flying a Canberra bomber equipped with a transponder that worked on the same frequency as the Meditech system.
Mm-hmm.
And they flew programmed tracks across the antenna field at night. And as part of the calibration process, the antenna field had right in its center an astrographic camera. That is a camera that could be driven at sidereal rate to mm-hmm. keep the stars in a fixed point on the camera plate, which was a 10 by 12, I think it was, glass plate. Now, to calibrate the antenna field, the Canberra bomber would go across the field with its transponder on, sending a downlink signal. But it also received station time sent up to it on the uplink, which would flash a xenon high-intensity flash in this particular piece of gear mm-hmm. that sat in the open bomb bay doors.
Okay.
And so as the plane flew over the field, it was pulsing light, which we recorded against the star background. And of course, later on, when you tried to find these things, it was like looking for a needle in a haystack. But you could have, you know, Ned Kelly was pretty good at doing this. We did a couple of antenna calibrations while I was there,
mm-hmm.
and Ned would pore over these plates for ages, just ringing the transponder flash. Because what you'd do is you'd have a star chart, which was which was of the right scale that you could put straight over the plate
yep.
as you looked at it, and you would match all the stars up, and the one dot that wasn't a star had to be the camera, the flash. So anyway, when when all this data was taken and bundled up with the Sanborn chart recorder of these radio signals, the flashing light with the time code on it, I'm not sure whether that was resolved at Woomera or whether it went off to Goddard and we got numbers back.
Mm-hmm.
But we would know the numbers of the phase angles when there was a meridian crossing.
Mm-hmm.
And when you saw the spacecraft coming along, the different channels would be going at different rates. The coarse channel would be very slow moving. The fine channel would be going flip, 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 flip from mm-hmm. one side to the other sort of business. So you were able to estimate when you were approaching the Meridian Crossing. And that was the only bit of data that Goddard was really interested in with the digital punch tape. So what you did was you eyeballed the Sanborn recorder. As the Meridian Crossing was approached, you turned on the punch paper tape, which turned out yards and yards and yards. And when you thought you'd seen it go through and given it a fair distance of 10 or 15 seconds, you turned the paper tape off. And you then went and took the paper tape off the Sanborn, rolled it out on one of the big long chart tables, double-checked the meridian crossing. You actually ruled a line through the meridian crossing point and again and up onto the time, and you determined the actual time to the nearest second off the chart. Now, the punch paper tape was a lot more accurate than that. You just made sure you sent a bracket of the tape that covered plus and minus 10 seconds or 15 seconds, I can't remember the amount.
Right.
And you sent that off as a teletype message to Goddard. And that was essentially a pass of the Minitrack system.
Was the camera used for other purposes or only for the calibration?
The camera was used for other purposes. The early experiments in over-the-horizon radar transmission used an inflatable balloon satellite. It was called Echo One.
Oh, I remember seeing Echo One.
I'm scratching to remember the exact year of that. That must have been about 1960 or somewhere around about there.
Mm.
But there was Echo One and Echo Two were those passive radio transmission experiments. And as part of the tracking process, they didn't have any downlink at all. So they were tracked optically with the Minitrack optical tracking system, or MOTS. And that was the astrographic camera in the center of the antenna field. And what you would do is, when you were scheduled for an optical track, you would load up a glass plate, and you would pick a point at along the predictions that you were given, where you would take the image. I can't remember if they specified what point we had to do or whether we were given a range, but you would set the camera up, set the sidereal drive on at this particular reading, make sure the time code was pulsing the relay that actually deflected the glass plate by a couple of millimetres, and the delays that it took to move that plate were all calibrated, and so you knew when you took the image and you took it inside and you developed it in a photographic solution. You could see a line, well, hopefully you could see a line if you'd done the job right,
mm-hmm.
Going across the plate, which was the image of the balloon as a spot of light. As it tracked across the plate, it just left a line, and the line was deflected by the time code from the serial decimal time code generator in the Minitrack timing system. So you would then be able to determine exactly, against the star background, the time that this spacecraft went across the plate.
Very clever, isn't it?
Yeah. It was interesting. It was really, really interesting. This stuff, to get thrown into this from my other background, and I just revelled in it. And, you know, the guys that had been there since the setup of the original Minitrack system, the 108 Mag Minitrack, which was the first 1958 vintage Minitrack, they were always helpful and knowledgeable. And this Minitrack I'm talking about, the frequency was changed to 136 megahertz somewhere in the 1961 era.
Because
that's when they came out from G-range, built a G-range, and it was a Fraunhofer trailer setup. The whole of the original 108 Mag Minitrack was based in a trailer, which came out from the US. Some of the early people involved in that ended up going to NASA. I am not sure, and I'd need to reread Doug Mutchway's book to see whether or not he was involved with Minitrack or whether he was involved just at the range himself, mm-hmm. but he was a weapons research man that did go to NASA.
So when the Minitrack moved to Arnold Lagoon, that was after DSS-41 had already been built, wasn't it?
It was in the same process,
right.
As far as I know. You know, though, you might be able to find in some of the departmental records information about that, but it was before my time. When I appeared in June 1962, both places were there and established and running.
So at that stage, was the Baker Nunn tracking camera there, or did that come later on?
No, it was still out at G Range.
Uh-huh.
And it didn't come until, I would say, 1963 somewhere. It could be later, 63, somewhere around about there it came out.
And that was used for similar kind of tracking, I guess, was it, or was it?
It's a purely optical system. It was run by Smithsonian. That was SAO, Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, WRE staffed it, but I think that, like we sent stuff to Goddard, I think they might have sent stuff to Smithsonian.
Right.
But it was installed as one of the devices to track the optical image of the first spacecraft that the Americans launched. So that was like belt and braces, if you like. They didn't really know whether the Minitrack system would be enough, and they had this very powerful tracking telescope, and that's in the book Woomera by Southall. So that was Baker Nunn. Now, the guys that used to work at G Range, they knew the Baker Nunn people. I never really got to know them, because when you're on shift, you know, you'd turn up on your shift time, you would do your shift. The only time you might run into them is if you happen to be working a day shift and they were on a day shift, and we had a common mess area where the admin centre for Island Lagoon was. That was where Dr. Gerard's office was, and one of the early admin officers, a bloke called Cassidy. God, how can I remember that? he was a clerk. He did all of the pay with allowances and whatever. So I guess that's...
Yeah, as you go along the road in, you turn left to go to DSS 41 and turn right to go to...
Yeah, that was right at the junction there. Yeah, there was an admin area, small recreation area, and a kitchen that cooked lunch for the people who happened to be on site, and a dining room. When we came out on shift, we came out in a Commonwealth car with a driver, and there would have been five of us in the car. In those days, there were bench seats in the front. So when we were on shift, that's the way we got to work. In the day shift period, there was a bus, and we used to have to stop at the guardhouse, which was on a downhill slope, and the Commonwealth Police would come through to check the passes. Mm-hmm. And I have talked about it, a chap called Pat Delgado, who's just recently passed on. Pat used to always say, bus full of scientists for Island Lagoon, to the Commonwealth policeman, who didn't take any notice whatsoever and just wanted to see you pass.
So they're pretty careful with security then?
Yeah, security was reasonably tight, although I suppose if you had wanted to bypass it, you probably could have, just for human foibles. So that's introduction and a little bit of the background of what the Minitrack system was, its relation to Island Lagoon and the dish. And my first job there was as a lowly technician. I did get a promotion later on. The first year that I was there, I was engaged to be married. I left here, Brisbane, as an engaged man. I went down to Woomera, and I thought, oh, well, this is a bit different being away. I just grow a beard. So that's what I did. I grew a beard, and when I came back 6 months later to get married, I turned up with this beard. Nobody knew me, especially my future wife. She didn't want to know about it. Get that thing off. So anyway, my first year was an interesting year. A lot of learning and different things. But the beauty of the place was it had state-of-the-art equipment and the test equipment. You know, I'd never seen stuff like it before. Frequency counters. I'd never seen one, even though these were old Hewlett-Packard valve-driven frequency counters. They had horrible dividers that were driven by a thing called a Fantastron circuit, and when they went bad, they were terrible. But I'd never seen equipment like that before. And all the telemetry, the ability to be able to decode on site the actual telemetry subcarriers was just a little bit of interest. You couldn't really make any sense out of it, but you could put on a chart when this thing was the telemetry was warbling away. You could decode that and see pulses coming out of it, which meant something to somebody. So that was my work at Woomera. I worked at the Minitrack site. I never really got to work at the dish, although one of my good friends who I was in the mess with and we joined on the same day, Rudy Langeveld. Rudy, Colin, can't remember his name, there were three of us, we joined the same day. They both worked at the dish. Oh, and Glenn Pope. We occasionally would go over to the dish while they were tracking, and it was Mariner Venus, I know, and we would just see what was going on, but we were never really had any opportunity to work there. When I came back as a married man in the village, there was no instant married accommodation. You got put on the list for married accommodation. So my wife, I'd organised with her to stay with my mate Bill Miller and his wife, and I just had single man's quarters. I'd moved up in status from being in the wooden bunkhouse system to brick single men's quarters, which gossip had it was a lot of American money had been put into the brick accommodation in Woomera. Yeah, the American money, it was said, and I've got no basis for this other than hearsay, was largely spent in a distributed way around Woomera rather than all for the people who happened to work on the Island Lagoon functions. And you can understand why that would happen. But the accommodation I was in was brick single men's flats. There were some brick married quarters around the place, and the gossip had it that was all American money. The thing I was getting to was my wife had to stay for a couple of weeks with Bill and his family, during which time she got a job in the hospital as a nurse.
Okay.
So she got accommodation there, single person's accommodation. I was in single person's accommodation in the men's flats. And so, you know, it was a bit of sneaking between different places. But after 3 months being on the waiting list, we did get a single flat of our own, which was one of the brick flats on Benuel Avenue. And that was quite a nice arrangement. It was just a bed sit. So being there and married, then it was the problem was Maria was on shift, I was on shift, and you'd end up writing each other notes.
Yeah.
So it was quite interesting. Eventually, she got a different job, a day job, which cut out a lot of those difficulties.
Because your shifts would have been all over the place, were they?
They were. It wasn't really anything regular, like a week of nights, a week of days, and a week of afternoons. It wasn't quite that regular. It had some semblance to that, but it was all over the place initially. During the late portion of 1962, I think that Goddard must have put some pressure on weapons research to get more staff, because sometime early in 1963, contractors appeared from Hawker Siddeley, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the contractors were Tony Keeler, who I'll talk about later,
mm-hmm.
Peter Papps, Peter Topley, I think Les Whaley. There were quite a few contractors that suddenly started to appear to bolster our shifts. When that happened, we started to get a bit more regular rotating shift arrangements. When you were on, this is another little interesting aside, when you were on afternoon shift or night shift, because the mess wasn't open, the canteen, sorry, I wouldn't call it a mess, the canteen wasn't open down at the admin area, you used to get supplied what were called B rations. There was a piece of steak, a tomato, a do-it-yourself dinner. And at Minitrack, they had a little kitchenette. They had a stove and a fridge and a table and whatever, so you could cook your own meal. Just the old public service mentality, you know, if you're out in the field, you will be supplied with bee rations.
Jan Delgado talked about the brown snakes.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of those?
Yeah, I remember that. Well, some of the pictures I sent you, one of those had a bit of imagery of the water that had accumulated in a wet patch. And, again, I think it must have been 1963. The snakes came out as a result of that, and I can remember one being in the Minitrack building. I can remember one being outside, and I was bashing it with a big piece of coax cable. And then I remember Pat Delgado being the hero, grabbing one by the tail and cracking its head off. So. Yeah, what happened was, after that rain, the desert bloomed, as it is doing probably right now. The moths resulted from all the caterpillars, and the place was just full of moths. You know, where there was a light, there were 500 moths. I remember somebody or other going through the Minitrack building just spraying something. It could have even been kerosene as a fine vapor, just to kill all these moths. It was terrible. Anyway, the snakes came out as a result of that as well. Yeah. So, just to sort of finish off the Woomera thing, I was on shift with Tony Keeler, who was notionally the shift supervisor. He was a contractor. He was had been in the Royal Australian Air Force in Korea, along with Ben, can't think of Ben's surname, you know, Ben of infamous fame. Tidbinbilla. Anyway, they knew each other from Korea. Tony was the shift supervisor towards the end of 1963, and we had a couple of others. Peter Papps was one of our group, and somebody or other. There was generally about four. The shift was about four. So Tony and I got on okay, and that proved useful later on at Tidbinbilla when Tony appeared over there. I'll just finish off by saying we got wind that there was going to be another dish built in the Canberra environment, and Hawker Siddeley contacts, and that's where Peter Papps came in. Peter knew what was going on. Peter said, yeah, they're building a dish. Why don't you go and see them on your way back to Brisbane when you go on holidays? And so I did. I called in to see John Galbraith, who was Spacetrack's general manager at Canberra, and I said, I'm keen to come across here from Woomera. I've got all this experience. Well, it'd be great, but we can't employ you directly. I said, why? Well, you're working for WRE. They won't allow us to pinch their staff. So I said, what can I do? And he said, well, the only way you can get out of this is to either stay where you are or explode out of it. And so I, being young and full of confidence, I just had my holidays in Brisbane. I came back and I told them that I was going to quit. And that's what I did. I quit somewhere around about August 1964. Mm-hmm. It would have been August. And while I was being in Brisbane on holidays, I'd lined up a job with Channel 9 TV. And I came back to Brisbane and worked as a technician in Channel 9 studios up at Mount Coosa. And then Hawker Siddeley, who were part of the consortium making up Spacetrack put out some adverts for technicians in about October of that year, and I applied, got interviewed, and was selected for a job at Tidbinbilla to start on the 4th of January 1965.
Tidbinbilla would have been, it wasn't open at that point, but would have been operational?
No, it was still in the shakedown phase. The equipment was all there, but it was still being checked out. People like John Heath were cognizant of a particular subsystem, and they had been initially sent to Woomera, to the dish at Woomera, to see what went on in the early part, and then they'd spent time at JPL understanding their subsystems.
This is part one of an interview recorded with Bruce Window for honeysucklecreek.net by Colin McKellar on the 16th of March 2010.